Until we're fully enlightened, we will have attachments. There's no, you just don't have a choice about that. It's the nature of being born a human. We say intrinsically that you wouldn't have been born except because of your attachments. There's a clinging in the human's basic being. There is a structure which is motivated. So I like the word motivated, driven to exist. And so at the root of things, there's an engine, and this engine is operated by, it runs on mistakenness. That's its fuel. This mistake is about what will bring you true well-being and happiness. And so we make a lot of choices, and we are driven by what seems to us to be clear and good ideas about what will make us happy. And unless we have a very high spiritual IQ, we won't figure it out that certain things have a problematic nature. And sometimes things take a while to display their problematic nature. So we invest heavily in certain things, and then after a good period of time, perhaps, they yield the opposite of what we thought they would. So this is the nature of attachments. But we don't have a choice about not being attached. And so here's another thing that you might have formulated in your own mind, the idea that this is about, this practice of Buddhism, of Buddhist meditation, is about coming to the end of desire. We quite often use desire and attachment as kind of synonyms, but so coming to the end of desire, and it occurs to us that then we should be desireless. We shouldn't desire to come to the end of desire. And you'll hear this is a kind of a conversation it might be have on the street with somebody that has read some Buddhist books or something like that. You know, you have to just be desireless. Like, oh, you're trying. See, that's your problem. You're going to meditation retreats and you're trying. See, that's the thing. You just stop trying. Stop being, don't try to get enlightened. But this is all confusion. Total confusion. Nothing to do with what the Buddha said. The Buddha explicitly had this conversation. Lots of original thinkers were around at the time, argued with the Buddha as well. He said, no, of course. The default mode is you have attachments, you have desires, you have clinging. It's in the nature of being born. And the idea is to figure out how to get free of this. And this getting free of it is the path to freedom, and it requires types of desires. You do need motivation, and you need to develop. If you're not motivated, you need to develop motivation. And sometimes we're not always motivated. You know, it's like on a nice afternoon, and there's shade of a tree. It's like, what was all that suffering about? I forget. But if you just got a little unfortunate diagnosis at the clinic, a strange sense of urgency that, you know, life isn't going to go on like this forever. There's all kinds of, it's fraught with peril. And that is a motivator. In fact, the Buddha suggests that you turn up the urgency knob on the side of the fact that this life is very uncertain, very unstable, unpredictable, and the only thing we can be sure of is that we're not gonna get out of here alive. So that makes Gives you energy, and I hope that it doesn't give you a sort of a anxiety energy. We're not trying to get that kind of fear energy. We're trying to get a lucid energy, realizing we have a situation here, and we need all the clarity we can get to do this. And of course, all emergency training structures, the first thing they do is they tell you that, you know, what you learn is calm down first. Then the next thing you can do is be competent. One type of before you are compassionate, you should be competent. So a doctor's compassion is limited to his skills. I mean, a century ago, 2 centuries ago, often medicine was full of compassion. Might as well just drink snake oil, you know. Modern medicine has some effects that are scientifically demonstrated and so forth. So compassion in that case is like clear thinking, a lot of research. That's how it manifests. So compassion for yourself, the freedom that you're seeking, also requires a good deal of lucid exploration, good information, and consideration for the nature of the mind. And so, but we do need energy to come to the end of desire. We do have attachments, and those attachments, what is the one fortunate attachment? It is actually the attachment to meditation. And you'll also hear this. Oh, maybe you've heard of concentration, samadhi, or jhana. Stillness of mind. And sometimes you'll hear even people who are teaching Buddhism, oh, yeah, never mind that, just don't get attached to that. That's just... But why would they say don't get attached to that? Or even avoid it? That it's an indulgence. Or it's not insight. It's not that which leads to freedom. This is incorrect. The reason why is that you, according to the classical teachings of the Buddha, and this isn't just commentaries and so forth, this is the direct word of the historical Buddha as well as we can recover it, that part of your blueprint for being born a human is that you are attached to certain pleasures. And most people discover sensory pleasures, sights, sounds, smells, tastes, touches, and the pleasure of ideas. Certain good ideas have a pleasure all in their own. Intellectuals often prefer the pleasure of ideas to lunch, or sometimes even to sleep. It's a sensory pleasure, as are the tastes and the smells and the touches and the sights and the sounds of music and the sights of nature and beauty and so forth. These are all types of enjoyments and happinesses. And then there's another type, which is superior, actually, beyond that. But nevertheless, it is unstable and does not last forever. And that is the pleasures of meditation. When the mind comes to stillness, when you can let go of your preoccupations with the outside world, let go of sights and sounds, smells, tastes, touches, and ideas, and not be asleep. So we're not talking about when you're sound asleep and not dreaming, you are also free of the sensory world, but we want to be lucid, conscious, awake, more lucid than normal, and free of these hindrances. And that's a great, great pleasure. That is, the body is entirely at peace, or is kind of in the background. Is not really there. But the mind emotional structure has, at the very least, has a wonderful sense of joy to it. In the more reformed forms, refined forms of this, it has a stillness which is also a very subtle form of joy, moving towards stillness, equanimity. It's very fine, very, very pleasant. Hard to describe. These are types of pleasures which are already in your system, and most people go through life without encountering them. They encounter the sensory, but it never occurs to them to sit down very, very quietly for extended periods of time in low sensory situation and focus their mind, and so they never come across it in their whole life. You can blunder across this occasionally. Some people will blunder across it. They're out on a camping trip, they're in a different situation, or they're in nature by the shore, the ocean, and the waves are washing in, the stars are coming out, and they have nothing to do, and maybe they haven't, they've been in a kind of calm environment for a while, and then they find themselves experiencing a profound stillness and peace. Well, that event might be so memorable that they never get over it, and they wonder what happened to them. And they might interpret it as a religious experience, and it really is a religious experience. in fact, they may seek that again. But if they don't understand how that was created, how that happens, the causes that went into that, it's somewhat frustrating to get back to it. But it's the potential that's there in the mind. It needs the right conditions. So these are the deeper. This is the eighth factor of the Eightfold Path. The right serenity, stillness or concentration. In Pali, it's called samadhi. Sama meaning correct or right or perfect or beautiful, samadhi. You are in, even though you may have not even experienced it before, you're already attached to it. The moment you encounter it, you will bond to it. And that's why it's not dangerous or a problem. It's because you're already there. You're already attached to it. There's no getting around it. You can't bypass that. It's not something you can be careful with to not get attached to. You're intrinsically... only the person in the highest stages of enlightenment is not attached to it. And yet, a person in the highest stages of enlightenment, the last stage of enlightenment, the arahant, the fourth stage of enlightenment, would still... What would they spend their time doing after they attain enlightenment? They don't go out to parties anymore. They don't chit-chat, they don't watch football, they don't... Oh, I shouldn't even mention football today, should I? So, what do? They frequently dwell in samadhi. So before you're enlightened, samadhi is a very good idea. It strengthens the mind, helps the mind, and you will be attached to it. But it's something which leads to the end of attachment. It provides you some basis, some strength and clarity to help your voyage towards true insight, true lucid, wise awareness of reality that is not shakable, a type of relationship to things that you don't forget. So you notice that in your life, you've realized things from time to time. It's become apparent to you, become clear to you, but somehow you find yourself in the midst of something you decided you were not going to do again, and then you realize, hey, I thought I realized that this what the problem of this situation was. You've forgotten. You're back in it. So the wisdom although you had some lucidity there, the wisdom receded on you, and you forgot it. And that's why the word mindfulness that we use, sati, mindfulness, is also used, translated as memory, to remember, an informed memory of the truth of things. So this is the type of recollection and lucid memory and vigilance that the Buddha is urging us to try to establish within ourselves. Once we understand something, the nature of freedom, the nature of how we fall into coarser things, how we lose it, how we become anxious, how we become depressed, how we become stale, how we become angry, all of these, how we fall into these psychic irritants that are based on delusions. He says that because the strength of our memory is not adequate. And so he's urging us to develop the strength of memory and so forth, and also to that give us the suggest that there's no. It's very fortunate if you can come across these higher states of lucidity and balance and focus that is the eighth factor of the Eightfold Path, the Samma Samadhi, that is true stillness of mind, clarity of mind, balance of mind, lucid nature of mind, devoid of. How do you know you're there? Well, it's by first asking what's not there. The hindrances, the psychic hindrances, the five hindrances have been abandoned. Five, starting with sense desire, the strongest and most common sense desire, that is desire for the sights and sounds and smells and tastes and touches and ideas. And then secondly, the opposite, aversion. Some form of ill will, aversion is also gone. You have no aversion in you. You don't feel the slightest irritability or let alone hate, you know. Agitation has gone, that is that sense, the inability to relax, to be at ease, this excessive motion, like water that is agitated by air, too much wind blowing across the surface of water. The mind is, there are energies in the mind which disturb its clarity. As you can't see deep into the water when the waves and the ripples are there, so the mind, you can't see lucidly when the energy is agitating the mind. Then the stagnant quality of its opposite, the opposite of agitation is this devoid of, so it's kind of a slothful, heavy, depressive, stagnant kind of feeling. And that's where water, when it doesn't have any kind of flow through it, also becomes that way. Moss and slime grow on the surface and becomes opaque, not clear. This also is gone. And then finally, the last one is doubts, uncertainty and doubt about what you should be doing regarding the spiritual path, what you should be doing with your life, with your mind at this time. These doubts are gone. You're free from the doubts. All of this stuff. So this tells you that you are now on the threshold of something. Those normal hindrances or irritants of the mind have subsided. They have been abandoned temporarily, and you are still lucid and conscious. And by definition, you're right on the edge of the last stepping stone of the Eightfold Path. You're on the last stone. The next step could be right off the end of the path into some stage of freedom, which is irreversible. So that's the idea, is that it's not a circular path. You don't follow it forever. It actually goes somewhere, and you step out onto a stage where the mind no longer can forget what it saw. It's the forces of clarity are enough to undo confusion in the mind, undo its disinformation, misinformation, and lack of information. This light. So we say, like, you're moving in a party of fellow travelers toward a legendary mountain, which has some very nice features to it. And somebody is guiding you along, you're following along, but it's dark. And you've never seen this mountain. You don't know whether it's there, but you've heard it is, and you have some faith in this idea. So during this night journey, some lightning comes up, a flash of light, you see the mountain. Then it goes dark again. Right at the moment when you actually see the mountain, although you're not there, everything has changed. You're no longer just faithfully walking along, being guided. You actually saw that it was there, that it was real, and so forth. That is a transitional and transformational moment. That's a moment of insight. You saw it yourself. So what did you see? You obviously not a mountain. What you saw was how distress and problematic nature of existence is produced within your own mind, within the structure of your own mind. It's around this sense of identity, the conviction, the intuitive conviction of yourself has been, for a moment, illuminated, and there you saw that there really isn't such a thing. That the self is an assumption that is not there. It doesn't mean that you haven't got personality structures or characteristics or habit structures or anything. It just means that there's nothing truly substantial. You could say, that's me. That's a moment of endless possibilities opened up. You're really free to change. Now, when you hear me say, you're really free, and then I just said, you don't exist, now you're really free. So the Buddha says, don't worry about that, my friends, that's just language. And the wise person does not override the conventions of language. So I don't try to speak avoiding the use of I, me, or mine. I use those pronouns, but we use them understanding it's just a convention. It's not really pointed to something real. It's a convenient way of saying, you know, past me, the potatoes. You know, the me doesn't really have to be there. It gets to the place that needs to be. But anyway, this insight undoes huge amounts of complexities and delusion, you know, is a storyline behind the self that is just a story, fabrication. Famously convincing. Most people are convinced by the story of themselves. And if you happen to have made yourself a bad story, you know, it could be a scary story, it could be a sad story, it could be a disappointing story, it could be an egotistic story, could be a prideful story. It could be all kinds of stories which are famous in literature for having problems to them. They all have their own flavor of suffering. The Buddha is saying, we're going to undo these things. We're going to feel free, strangely free. The body remains. The mind remains. The emotional structure remains. But it's not focused around this mythological self. And now, we're not asking you to be selfless martyrs either. Like, I've got to sacrifice myself. I've got to get, I'm too self-centered. I've got to be doing service for everybody and forget myself and this kind of stuff. That's it's a tactic which often just produces a lot of angst and lack of satisfaction as well. There's definitely something to be said for learning how to open out and be generous and a little less selfish. There's a very famous experience. It's just like getting rid of a mud puddle you know, allowing the water to open into a lake. You know, it's a very refreshing to open out the small self into a larger sense of community and so forth. Very refreshing. As long as we do it in the right way with that motivation for expanding the self. The Buddha's saying, you know, it's not just expansion of the self. We have to get over this, the whole idea of identity. So this is the function of this what we're doing here, this bhavana, this cultivation. Yesterday we talked about the gardening project. So this is a gardening project. What is the garden is formed around some sort of boulder, the boulder of self, this delusion of substantiality of self. And so what we're trying to do is uproot this boulder, or find out that it's actually made of sand, it's not really a solid thing, and it just makes nice fertilizer for the rest of the garden. What remains, though, is the garden. Very beautiful things growing in that garden. There's shade, there's the cool element, the warm element, the juicy element, the dry element. All the balances, there's a number of different things that are beautiful, isn't it? Cold lemonade on a hot day is beautiful. Hot chocolate on a cold day is beautiful. I don't want to make you hungry. It's good that I do it after lunch, right? The cool lemonade on a hot day is equanimity, beautiful breeze blowing right through your mind. And the hot chocolate on the cold day is loving kindness and compassion. The heart is full. It's a rich, warming. But it's appropriate to that there's an element of coldness there. And so we're warm in the midst of coldness. But we also want to be cool in the midst of heat. So you see, the mind doesn't just stay on one thing. The Buddha switches back and forth from equanimity to loving kindness to compassion. He's saying there's a number of divine emotions. There's a number of beautiful places to be, and it's just hard to say which one is the most beautiful. They're all really nice. We're now all... This is a nice problem to have. Which one would you like to be in now? So that's what one does with one's life, is to decide, I've been to Angerville, and I will find my way out of that place. I've been to Lustville, Addictionville, Agitationville, Slothville. You've been to Doubtville? Or is it Doubtsville? The inhabitants sometimes. Doubtville, Doubtsville. These are steel foundry towns, you know. You want out there as soon as you can get out. There are beautiful places to go. Mettaville, Karunaville. These are love, compassion, sympathetic joy, and equanimity. Places which, if they left you there for the rest of eternity, it'd be too short. It doesn't wear out, ever. It never wears out. These are the divine emotions. However, even those divine emotions are transient, and so our ultimate realization, and it's a very high goal, and maybe this afternoon we won't get there to Nirvana, but it's good to know that there is a position of the mind where it realizes although it dwells in this and can immerse in loving kindness, in the cool beauty of equanimity, it does not get lost. It is even able to open its hands and be at ease, and without clinging to even these things. And that is a place of safety. So that's Nibbana, the place of safety, the sublime, the peaceful, the ultimate freedom. The hand in the mind does not close anymore. It just stays open, and it doesn't need to close. These beautiful states don't leave it. And the mistake we make all our life is grasping, closing, trying to hang on, and having things dissolve in our hands, ripped out of our hands. It's a hard lesson to learn. It's contrary to normal psychology, and that's why, of course, it's rare, but that's also why the Buddha is a genius. It's saying, actually, it's upstream. You want to get in the canoe and drift downstream, but there's a waterfall at the end. The stream is great. It's cool, beautiful, but you got to paddle upstream. it's a hard thing to learn, but it's not that hard. Ordinary people learned it, definitely in the time of the Buddha. Very ordinary people learned it, and some of them didn't take too long to learn it. If we can just get our minds intellectually around the idea that our best moments, just even from your own memory, the best moments in your life don't involve, you know, possessing things. They involve just being mysteriously at peace, at ease, for a minute or an hour or a day, or that was so wonderful. It was just, we're curious about how that happened. And so the Buddha is putting together systematically. He is a great teacher. He's not just a mystic. We're not just a philosopher. He's a good teacher. He's saying, this is how you do that. This is how you learn to do that. Take some time. Yeah, this is a study, but it's something that really worth studying. And watch your mind. Watch how it forms these psychic irritants and hindrances, such as anger. Anger is unwise attention to the fault. So whenever you're angry, you'll realize that you're focused completely on some fault somewhere, to the detriment of reality. Your reality never consists of just faults. A person never consists of just faults. You don't consist of just faults. You have one eye closed, and you're looking through just one eye. It's got a blue lens on it, so you're just seeing everything in blue, under blue light. The opposite for craving and wanting, and I need it, and I want that, and I must have that, is the other eye is closed. Now it's, you see just the beautiful, just the perfect aspects of things. That is, a red filter is on things. It's distorting the reality of things. Nothing in the sensory world is entirely beautiful. It always has a problem. There's a pit in the cherry. So when these things are happening in your mind, you start to become aware, oh, I'm seeing things with the blue filter on. I'm seeing things with the red filter on. I need to come back. I need to let that go and come back to the just the, under white light. Things look as they are. They appear as they are. So this is the experience of meditation, becoming more lucid, aware of your mental processes, how they distort things, and how they lead to unsatisfactory conditions. And when we practice with this, now this practice, by the way, is repetitive practice, interrupting, dismissing, replacing. So we talked about that yesterday. So what do? You don't just watch it. You interrupt it, if at all possible. So the first thing is dismiss it, if at all possible. The moment you recognize it, dismiss it. Don't just sit there with anger. Don't just watch it. Now this is sometimes, it's a remnant to some degree of certain schools of psychology in the West, is to investigate things, go into your suppressed whatever, you know, Freudian ideas. And this is not, Buddhism isn't Freudianism. It's just not the same. We're not trying to uncover these things. We're taking a different tact, and it works. The Buddha is saying, if you systematically do this, hundreds and hundreds of repetitions of this, the entire structure just starts to dissolve on you. It doesn't have the energies, the tenacity, the strength that it used to have. It just goes away by itself. It fades to the deepest level. And it's not, don't, no one should say that, oh, it's, well, yeah, but it's suppressed or something. It's not suppressed. It just eventually dissolves and is gone. It doesn't revive. It doesn't have any afflictive capacity. And this is the experience of many, many, you know, uncountable people over the thousands of years that is, this practice has been going on. I think in even in modern neuroscience, they can see that, you know, it's the, that the amygdala, you know, this little area of the brain to do with fear and so forth, can be, you can see that there's a change in this, the structure of it under, with this functional MRI and so forth. You can see that. You're actually changing your brain. So I only mention this stuff because it's the modern thing. So everybody's very interested in the brain. We don't care really about the brain. What we care about is the actual phenomena of how it feels to be you. How it really feels, not ideas about it, but how it feels. How does it feel? And the Buddha, there's only one thing for the Buddha. How does it feel? The first noble truth is suffering. That's a feeling, not an intellectual idea. Suffering. That's the problem. End of suffering, that's the solution. What would be the end of suffering? Not just the mere absence of suffering, but the presence of a profound, indescribable, ongoing well-being. That is free from fear, free from anger, free from all these afflictions. And that's not just neutral, that is incredibly positive. So this is where one is going with these exercises. You know, the nice thing, you don't need any special shoes to do this. No special outfit or anything like that. This is, and it's relatively cheap. No charge. But it does require, I'm sorry, Jesus can't help you with this. It just can't. Nor can the Buddha. Yes. Let's say that to be in association with people who are loving and calm and generous is wonderful teaching. You know, you can feel it. You can sort of get it by being around people. That's true. Another person can influence you that way, and it's a great way to be influenced. So hang out with those people that you want to learn something from. You know that they're joyful, they have energy, they're compassionate, they're listeners, they do things skillfully. By all means, you can learn directly off these people, but ultimately you have to internalize it, and it has to become you.